This podcast was created to record and share stories from the many rural women who have birthed, to allow them to voice their experience and learn from them. I want rural women who are pregnant, planning to get pregnant, or entering their postpartum period to feel supported and know that, although care may be via distance, there are options. Thank you for listening. This podcast is produced on Yuin Country. We acknowledge the innate birthing wisdoms and traditions held by the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, the traditional custodians of this land. We remember the first women of this nation, the custodians of land and birth, who birthed on country in culture and tradition. Here, as we share in stories of birth, preconception, pregnancy, and postpartum experiences from remote, rural, and outer regional communities, may we remember and stand for the cultural significance of birth, women's business, and birthing on country. May we nurture and support women through this rite of passage as we hear of possibilities ignited and limitations created. May we share in the power of storytelling and memory as we listen and learn from these birth stories. And may we always remember the ancestral wisdoms belonging to the country these birth stories occur on today. Today's episode is with Taryn. Taryn fell pregnant whilst living on a remote cattle station in the Gulf of Carpentaria. Living remotely, the closest quick access medical facility was 65 kilometres away in a clinic in Croydon. Although 65 kilometres sounds accessible, flooding was an issue and it was not a full-time facility. This facility was fly in, fly out, and a doctor was only available once a fortnight. During Taryn's first pregnancy, on the advice of friends in the medical field, she sought care with a private obstetrician in Brisbane at Mater Mothers. This obstetrician had experience working with rural women, and so the advice Taryn received was relevant and showed consideration of her circumstances. For Taryn to reach Brisbane, she needed to travel 2,500 kilometres from home. This drive took days, requiring numerous overnight stops, and so Taryn only saw her care providers at the beginning and at the end of her pregnancy. It is an official legislated requirement that remote birthing women relocate prior to birth. They are required to leave home during the possible birthing window. So Taryn relocated 6 weeks prior to her due date and began the process of waiting for her scheduled induction. She shares that although the drive was long and hard, being late in her third trimester, that was not as difficult as the trip home. On the return trip, travelling with a newly born infant who was learning to feed was difficult. After this first positive birth experience, Taryn felt like a birth expert, and so for her second pregnancy, she chose to birth closer to home at a small public hospital. This time, Taryn would relocate to her parents' house, only 1,000 kilometres away. Both her grandfather and her father had been born in this small rural maternity unit, and so going in, she felt good about this change of plan. Again, Taryn relocated 6 weeks out from her due date, Arriving in town 6 weeks prior to her due date allowed Taryn to begin care with her hospital. And rather than working with an obstetric specialist in this system, she experienced midwife-led care. Taryn went into labour naturally, everything seemed to be going well, but when things reached the pointy end and her son was crowning, his head would move in and out. A new doctor diagnosed that her baby was stuck, shoulder dysostosia. And so with hands-on assistance, her baby was born. Although, this meant Taryn sustained a high-order injury and needed to be transferred to Mackay. Having experienced two very different births and dealing with some trauma around her second birth, when Taryn found out she was pregnant for a third time, she sought an elective caesarean. She found the remote postpartum healing from caesarean a lot easier than it had been with her birth-related injury from her son's birth. Every one of Taryn's birth experiences was different. She is a strong, independent, and resilient person who took her remote care circumstances in her stride. But she also shares that having one good friend who understands and who can listen to and hear you makes all the difference in remote pregnancy, postpartum, and motherhood.
I have a loving husband and three children who are now 8, 6, and 4.
And whereabouts are you guys living?
We've recently moved to my husband's home block where he grew up and been in his family for almost 100 years. But previously, we bought another station in the Gulf, Carpentaria, and sort of located ourselves there for, I think it was 14 years maybe. And it was a very sort of starter block for us, a sort of basic house and not too many windows or doors and lots of snakes and all sorts of sort of modern olden days, I would call it, when we first got there, and had only been lived in by single men in the previous, you know, ownerships. So we really started from scratch up there.
Yeah. Have you always lived rurally, or did you come from the city and move rural?
I grew up in Blackwater, west of Rockhampton. Small mining town, went to school in Toowoomba, which is where I met my husband, as he was my friend's brother. And before moving to the Gulf, I'd spent 2 years in London. So came back to Australia and had my 21st birthday and then moved straight out to fairly severe isolation.
Wowza. So yeah. When you did fall pregnant, what services did you discover were in your area? And I know living remotely, it might be more of a measure of what was your closest service for maternity care?
Yeah, so I was away at the time of finding out I was pregnant. So I was in Toowoomba, and so I had my first GP appointment there and to confirm the pregnancy, and then basically from there I sort of had to guide myself to learn what I needed to do. So good family friends in Brisbane who have nursing background said, come to Brisbane, go straight to the top, go to the Mater Mothers, and you know you'll be well looked after. And you know, when you live that far away, you really need to be sure that things are, you know, well, with the most important thing in your life. So I thought that was good advice, and they gave me an obstetrician in Brisbane. So this was all private. He was an older fellow who had obviously many, many years of experience, and he was really lovely and had done lots of rural women before. So he had an understanding of distance and everything involved with that. As it was about 2,500 kilometres for us to drive to Brisbane.
Yeah. Nothing small there at all.
Yeah. So that's where we went, and I saw him at the beginning of the pregnancy, and then I didn't see him again until I left the Gulf to come down again.
Okay. So if you had needed support locally, what was available to you, or was it a matter of Royal Flying Doctor Service if you'd needed it?
Yep. So the closest town to us was Croydon, and it was about 65 kilometres from our station. And it was a lovely little clinic. And at the time, a doctor only flew in once a fortnight.
All right.
So I had to time my appointments if I wanted to see them. And then to do scanning or anything, I drove to Cairns or Townsville for any scans that I needed.
And what kind of a drive was that?
That was about 600 Ks, yeah. So...
So prenatal, it had quite a lot to do in terms of travel.
It's it was something that obviously it all had to be done. So you just booked it in and planned, did it. But yeah, it was fairly inconvenient to be pregnant up there, that's for sure.
Did they have anything at the time, like a video kind of conference, if you wanted to talk to a midwife, or was it really just appointments?
No, not really. And there wasn't, I didn't really see a midwife, to be honest. It was just either the GP or the clinic nurse on duty that I ever saw. And they were wonderful, you know. And they always had the RFDS on call if they needed anything. Everything went reasonably well apart from me being severely sick through the whole pregnancies.
Okay.
And otherwise everything went well.
And did you live near other people? So like if you needed a bit of friendship or support during your pregnancy, were there neighbours? Is that kind of, or were you so kind of isolated on this station that it was you guys and your own devices?
Pretty much on our own. I had two neighbours, and one of them was 65 kilometres away. And she had six children herself, so she was a great moral support and someone on the end of the phone if I needed anyone. Otherwise, it was pretty much on my own. The best thing I had during that pregnancy was through my private health insurance. They had a midwife give me a call as part of their pregnancy package. And I think she called, I don't know, once every 3 or 4 weeks or something. Okay. And I thought it was really nice someone to call me and talk to me about my pregnancy, rather than me having to reach out and try and find somebody all the time. So. Definitely, if that's, you know, if you look into your insurance policy, what they offer, that is a great tool.
So would she call you and it would be quite quick, or would you spend quite a substantial amount of time listening and talking about the different points
She would talk as I needed to. And could tell me whether it was something I needed to worry about or I was doing fine. Yeah.
And Was there anything else additional to that? Did you do any like extra courses, or what were kind of your feelings about birth before birth? Was it something that you're like, yeah, it's going to happen, or was there lots of reading or podcasts potentially? Or
no, so I didn't. I thought I wanted to do a class or something, but the logistics of everything was it just wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I basically read one of those Up the Duff books or
yeah, whatever. I love was, that book.
Yeah, and just sort of went through the stages with that. And my husband, bless him, would he would compare me to a cow and say, well, you know, when the cows are pregnant, they have these requirements, or they do this and that, and
yeah,
say, you know, that's normal. That's how we got through it, basically finding our own way.
I think that is quite a common kind of normalization of birth that occurs rurally, where you see animals just birthing all the time, so it's like, no, yeah, you can do this.
Absolutely. And I did sort of feel like that. There was one time we used to get really high rainfall up there, and so we'd be flooded in for months at a time, and one of my appointments was due and we were flooded in. Mm-hmm. And I rang the council or whatever the process was, and they said, what is it? And I said, it's just a checkup appointment, a general checkup. And they said, no, they wouldn't fly me out for that. That was, I just have to wait. So I thought, all right then, well, plenty of women have done this before. So I waited out until the floodwaters went down a few weeks later, and what was left of the road after flooding was fairly severe at times. If there'd been really high rainfall, it was, incredibly washed out. And so my husband took me to town on the back of a four-wheeler. And, like I said, it was 60 kilometres. The mailman met us, along the way. We would have probably done 40 odd Ks on the motorbike, bumping around over all these washouts with this big belly.
Yeah.
Just to make my, my checkup appointment.
Wow.
It was fine. It was all good.
Yeah, but big experiences,
Yeah. Yeah.
So then towards the end of your pregnancy, for your first birth, you did this massive relocation. When did you relocate, and whereabouts in Brisbane did you relocate to?
So they basically kick you out about 6 weeks prior from up there. Obviously, it's a very long way to help if something were to go wrong in the last stages. So.
So it is a mandatory move then, like it's kind of legislated. Yeah.
Absolutely. So we drove down to Brisbane and stayed with family friends for a while. And then my auntie and uncle were away, so said that I could stay in their house, which was really nice for some time. And we simply couldn't afford an apartment or something for 6 weeks, a really jolly long time to have to rent for. And then not knowing whether you'd go overtime as well, it could be much longer than. We were fortunate to be able to stay with others. My husband obviously went back home to the farm and continued working there until I think maybe 10 days or so before my due date, he came back to Brisbane.
Yeah, not easy to zip back and forth.
Yeah, absolutely. And to be honest, being my first pregnancy, I didn't enjoy being in other people's places. I because I didn't know what was going to happen. What if I go into labor or my waters break on somebody else's couch? Like, really insignificant stuff when you think about it now. But it is a real downside of having to be somewhere else, not in your own home. That's for sure. But yeah, quite daunting. And yeah, all went well there as much as it could, I guess.
So how did that drive go? That's a massive drive, 2,500 kilometers.
Yeah.
I know I started complaining about 2.5 hour drives at about 36 weeks pregnant. Like, how did you manage 2,500 days?
Yeah, we did it over a couple of days. And there were a lot of stops. My feet would swell and, you know, you'd get unbelievably uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was fine. You do what you do, don't you? The way home with the baby was a different story.
Yep. And when you were relocating, did you find that things cropped up that you hadn't considered? Or so you've said that you were like, oh, I didn't really want to be around people. But was there anything else about the whole relocation thing that kind of cropped up for you?
Not really, only just that you never switch off, even when you're not at home, and thinking of everything that needed to be done, you know, while you're away. It's just, you know, it's an unpleasant experience being away that long. I can definitely say that.
It's not really that downtime, that nesting time, that easing into new life. It's active.
And like I said, I read books and they're like, you know, spend this last week doing this and preparing that. And I just
didn't have access to those.
And you sit in Brisbane, you know, and somebody else's home with, you know, you don't even have anything to do.
Yeah.
Time passes by slowly.
And did you have any false starts with, like, Braxton Hicks, either at home on the station or in Brisbane?
No, nothing.
So having done the massive relocation, I don't know if anyone will beat you in terms of kilometres. that's a lot of kilometres to relocate. What advice would you give to people who need to relocate or traverse exceptional extreme distance in order to give birth?
Only just get everything sorted beforehand and, you know, stay busy until then and, you know, set yourself some tasks that you can do while you're away. You know, arrange photos, you know, do things that you can take with you and do while you're away.
So your hospital, you had seen it before because you'd gone earlier in your pregnancy and then you arrive now towards the end of your pregnancy. What were the facilities like at Mater Mothers in Brisbane?
Amazing. Yeah. Had a room to myself. The birthing suite was huge and lovely. Had a view out the window. It was, you know, you felt like you're somewhere that was really top quality. I really would recommend Mater Mothers in Brisbane. Yeah.
And having been there at the beginning and now at the end, did you find that you still felt supported by your team at the hospital? Like, was it possible to still have a nice connection with them even though you'd come from far away and not had that continuity of care?
No connection with the midwives. You just have I just had whoever was on, and obviously hadn't met them, although I was lucky enough to sort of know a lady who did help me through a bit of stages and came in and checked on me and things. But you know, the team were lovely and they did know our situation, so we're great. And the obstetrician, like I said, he was very aware of what was going on and suggested that I be induced, just simply to help me with my time management and stress and anxiety and everything else.
I was
39 and 4 or something, very close to right on 40 weeks. I felt like, you know, she was very ready to come anyway. I started having some, you know, different sort of feelings and things like that. So I didn't feel like she was early at all. And I absolutely had the option to not do that.
Yeah.
As we all know, being induced is not the preferred way to go. But yeah, like I said, the anxiety and stress of just not knowing how long we were going to be there and all of that was, you know, we decided, yeah, we would do the induction.
And what kind of induction did you have?
Was it had the Syntos.
Did your body respond well to the Syntosin?
Well, I most definitely started into labor very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously I hadn't been to any birthing classes, hadn't written a birth plan, hadn't, you know, very little birth experience. But I did know that being induced, you know, brought everything on much faster and would be more painful. So, you know, I decided I wanted to try and do it without too much intervention, but within it would have been an hour, I'd asked for an epidural. So I was given that. That was a bit scary in itself, just having, you know, the big needle in your back.
Having to stay still while it's put in.
Pretty frightening. But once I'd had that, obviously the pain subsided and I was out again and, you know, have a party, it was all good. but that slowed down my contractions as well, you know. When you intervene with nature, things, you know, slow down and different things happen. So it took a while then for me to get into full labor, ready to push. I think 7 o'clock in the morning they started the induction, and it wasn't till about 4:30 in the afternoon when I was ready to push. So and what an experience, being told to push down in your bottom where you have no feeling. The strangest sensation, like I wasn't in pain or anything. And then when they're telling me to push and, you know, you think you're pushing, it feels like you're pushing your head off the child because you're just so, you know, trying your best, but you can't feel what you're doing. Very strange experience that was. And then she was having a little bit of trouble coming out, and so the obstetrician used the Ventose extraction, the little cap, like a vacuum to stick on the head and help manipulate and pull her out. And that was all done easily and well and no damage. And, like I said, I do believe that was because he was a very experienced obstetrician and he did pride himself on not causing injury and things. So he certainly delivered there.
And then when she came out, she was feeling all good and straight up to you?
Yeah, straight to me. She was a little bit blue, took a little bit of time to take a breath, but she got there and then came straight to me. I think she might have even went straight to the breast. And, everything sort of was fine, basically.
Yeah.
Again, with the epidural, then do the placenta all while I'm gooing and garring over my baby because what's going on. It all went pretty well.
And because you were from far away, did they let you stay in hospital for a bit longer, or did you want to leave sooner? What was your hospital stay like then?
Hospital stay was great. I delivered newspaper in the morning and we were like, yeah, let's stay here. And she actually had a couple of issues. I had so much milk that she would cut off her airways and turn herself blue because she was getting choked of milk. So that would happen like when I had a bit of engorgement. And so the obstetrician was very good and he would say, you know, if you want another day, I'll sign you off. You can stay another day. and it was lovely and we didn't feel pressured or anything. And I think we were there about 4 or 5 days.
Okay.
Before we made the treacherous trek home with a newborn.
So after discharge, you jumped straight in the car and went home from the hospital? Or did you stop with friends?
I think we might have stayed one night. Mum and dad came to visit and then we stayed a night and then we drove home.
Stopping along the way still, like dry the day and...
Yeah, so 4-hourly breastfeeds.
Okay.
So stop on the side of the road and I had to lay down to feed so that she could suck uphill so that she wouldn't choke. So I have to sit my chair right back and... I do remember at one point being in tears on the side of the road, saying, I can't do it. I don't want to go any further.
That would be really hard as an early breastfeeding woman, like trying to navigate latch and everything, lying down to feed in a car.
Like most husbands, when they get in a car, they just want to get going and just drive. But my husband was very good and supportive. And he said, no, look, we'll just take as long as you need. Don't stress. Because I did always have that, come on, let's get this feed done. Kept moving. Yeah. Otherwise, it's going to take us a week to get home. It was fine after that.
I think a lot of people would have a lot of empathy for you with the side of the road, you know, the dirt track feed in a way. I've been there. Sometimes after dark.
Experience. Yeah.
You got to stop where you got to stop sometimes.
That's it. That was all good. And then we got home to the farm with a newborn, obviously very isolated. I guess I did feel alone, kind of like, but I was okay with that. I do think becoming a mother made who I am. So I was like, her and I together, a team, and we're going to do this, you know. and I had no other option really but to just tough it out. And then a child health nurse came to Croydon, I think it was maybe once every 4 or 6 weeks or something.
Yeah.
So I could take her in and get her weighed and checked and things like that. And so that was, that's how it went down.
Yeah. In-home midwife visits were not a reality when you live that far out. No.
No, that's right. I did probably have a lot of calls to my neighbor, what am I doing? And my mom, of course, who was a great support, but there wasn't really too many others around, that I knew with a newborn, that I could, call on. So, I think again, I turned to a book And I went with the Tizzy Hall, Save Our Sleep. And the reason I loved it was because it just told me what to do now, you know, with my baby, and found it so, so helpful.
Really hard not having like a community of voices, just having your own devices. That would be a really intense experience. So in a way, there was zero postpartum care available for you, but there was a child nurse who would come out and weigh the baby, and that was just every so often at the clinic.
It was, like I said, it was a pretty lonesome journey. But yeah, I was fine with that. That's what I'd signed up to. And yeah, it was okay.
Yeah. Were there any kind of shape or form of mother's group, even digitally or remotely, or was it mostly how you said you connected with your neighbor who was 65k away and your mum?
Basically that. Occasionally a couple of mums in town, we would get together and have a smoko and take the children.
Which up in Croydon.
Might have been maybe three or four other mothers with different various aged children that I would come and see. I remember once driving to town, I thought, yeah, I really need a day out today. I'm going to take her. You know, we decided every second, I can't even remember, Monday or Tuesday, whatever it was, we would do these. I really needed a day out, so I drove to town, and I got there, and the mums decided they weren't doing mother's group that day. And just arrived in town, and I was like, wow, you know.
That's a big drive to then not have something.
Any of theirs, but except my, you know, I could have contacted someone, and I was like, right, and there's not too much to do in Croydon.
Okay.
I think I went and saw the lady at the BP, who's lovely, up for a chat, and then drove home again.
Oh. So to give a bit of a map of not being too much to do in Croydon, what kind of size is that town? Like what exists there? We've got a BP.
Got a BP, a cafe, and a pub. Not much more than that.
Enough to be able to drive through and keep on driving.
Because
you got your fuel in terms of food and petrol.
A pub, beautiful little town, very tidy, and obviously, like most little towns, the people are what make Croydon a lovely place.
So your first birth, how did that kind of then shape your feelings about what it meant to birth rurally, and were there things that you needed that just can't or couldn't at the time be offered rurally?
Like I said, you know, like I felt alone, but I was okay with it. So we just guided, you know, each other. We just went with what we went with. And my husband was obviously my greatest support. So I was very lucky, you know, that he he's very practically minded and very calm, and would help me out on those moments, as all mothers do when you think, oh, why is this baby not stopping crying? And obviously the things that you would like are things that you can't have. So, you know, someone to drop the baby off to, someone to go and see and have with, all of those things, you know, that it's not going to happen if you're living that remote. So you have to be mentally tough enough to just deal with it on your own.
I hear you. So there's 2 years then between number one and number two, is that right?
Yep.
How did you go about making your care choices for your second birth after your first birth experience?
Yep. So my second, I was like, I'm a pro and I do not need to drive 2,500 kilometres. I'm going to go 1,000 kilometres to and stay with my mum and dad.
Okay.
So fantastic, as in I was comfortable at my parents' place. It was a bit closer. And yeah, like I said, second time around, first baby came out okay. The second one will be a breeze. So I'm not even going to go private. I'm going to go public in the small country hospital that they're in. And it was great having them, because obviously I had the older child to contend with as well, so they could help out.
Now you got to think, where do they go when I'm giving birth?
Exactly. So that was fantastic, and she even attended a little daycare center there a couple of days a week, which she thoroughly enjoyed the socialization. I thought it was a really great opportunity for her.
So would you do the 1,000 kilometres every week then for daycare?
No, just stayed there 6 weeks.
Okay.
From the 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So again, just went there at the beginning of the pregnancy and then did the rest of the care through the Croydon Clinic.
Yeah. Okay. So prenatal care was very much the same as last
very
time
much
then.
The,
yeah.
Yeah. And then, yeah, and then 6 weeks prior, I went to Proserpine and sat there with my parents and then had midwifery care.
Okay.
So you don't see an obstetrician, you just see the midwives. I think it was up to a weekly basis then, fortnightly towards the end. And all was looking good. Again, I was sick the whole pregnancy until the day I gave birth. So a challenge when you have an older child as well. And went into labour at my parents' place in the middle of the night, as they tend to do. Popped in the shower for a little bit. Well, let my husband have a little bit extra sleep. And then, I thought, no, they're getting closer and better. I'll wake him up and we'll go to the hospital.
So around what time did you go to the hospital?
I think it was around 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And was it quite close to your parents' home, or was it a little bit of a trek away?
No, just in the town, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, 4 or 5, not far. And got to the hospital and, everything's good. Yep, you're in active labour. Let's come in, get sorted. And so I thought, oh, great. Well, you know, the baby will be here soon.
Mm-hmm.
I laboured all through the night, through the early hours of the morning, and just stayed in the shower most of the time.
Okay.
And because I thought I was such a pro, I decided that I really wanted to have no intervention this time after my last birth. And I wanted to feel it all. I wanted to, you know, be able to feel when I was pushing and have whole natural birth experience.
Yeah.
So I chose to not have anything for this birth, which is possibly one of my biggest mistakes. I sort of progressing, and I was dilated and was pushing. And then by this time I was up on the bed. I think I was on all fours, and the baby's head would crown and then go back in and crown and go back in. And the midwives seemed confused. I guess I was a bit sort of, you know, in so much pain and so much trauma as you are towards that stage of your birth. I didn't really realize what was going on, but my husband was really getting quite stressed. And this was going on for some time, and the midwives were chatting to each other and saying things like, oh, it's not coming, it's something wrong, it's stuck. And yeah, my husband said, do I need to push the emergency button? And they sort of looked at each other, these midwives, and they said, yes, yeah, push it. And so he did. And obviously a small country hospital. And so the emergency button was hit and every available medico in the hospital came into the room. Luckily there was one little young doctor there who I think she'd only just finished training. She just, everyone was sort of a bit like, didn't know what to do. They were a bit stressed, we could tell.
How were you feeling?
She ended up just, like I said, I just trusted that, you know, I didn't know what was going on, but trusted that something would eventuate soon. And bearing in mind, no pain relief for this one.
Yeah.
And the doctor put her hands inside and yanked the baby out, who had shoulder dystocia. His shoulder was stuck right behind my pelvis, and hence the reason he wouldn't come out. And yeah, she pulled him out, and in doing so caused a whole heap of damage to myself. And I ended up with some severe tears and damage. Anyway, they pulled the baby out and I didn't really know anything was wrong or what have you.
Yeah.
They had given me a shot by then of whatever they give you a shot of to try and numb the pain a little bit.
Sure.
And, you know, pulled him out. He was incredibly swollen in the face. He could barely open his eyes. And yeah, he was all sorts of colours and shades of blue. And eventually he started crying and all was well. And I thought, okay, you know, no worries. That was a bit traumatic, but anyway, we're fine. And they're all talking around and what have you, and gave the baby to me, and they're all talking about how big he was. And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess he's big. You know, I don't really know. This is my previous baby was 7 pounds. My first child was 7 pounds. And they're all guessing, oh, wonder how big he is. How big is he? And they asked me, how big do you think he is, before they weighed him. And I said, oh, I know the last one was 7. Maybe he's 8 pounds. I don't know. Anyway, they put him on the scales and he was 10 pounds 4. And, you know, and they're like, obviously, this is the reason we couldn't get him out. And he was so stuck. So they had arranged for an ambulance to relocate me to the Mackay Hospital. Okay. For emergency repair. And I wanted him to come with me, but of course you need a specialized neonatal ambulance to carry a baby.
Yeah.
So he couldn't come. So I was taken to Mackay. It's about an hour and a half from where I was. And then
what's that like, being transferred by ambulance after having given birth? How were you going?
Fairly traumatic. I did not want to be separated from my newborn. But again, I'm pretty cool with just going with the flow and trusting in, you know, medical professionals. And they took me to Mackay, where I was, put into emergency surgery there for repairs. In the meanwhile, they did skin to skin with my husband and my son. So they wrapped a big sheet around both of them. And funnily enough, one of the midwives had said to me prenatally, have you ever heard of prenatally expressing colostrum? And I was like, no.
Okay.
She's like, oh, gave me some syringes and said, go home and pump once a day or something and put them in syringes. So I did and had them in the freezer. Mm-hmm. And so we called my dad and said, I've got to go to a hospital. Can you bring those syringes up?
Yeah.
And so my husband fed him his first feeds of expressed colostrum, which is crazy to think, isn't it? Why did I do that? I haven't, you know.
Hadn't done it the first time, but yeah, lucky little piece of golden advice there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then he sort of, my husband was going to come to Mackay with him, although they wouldn't allow him to go until his stats were picking up.
Okay.
His blood sugar levels dropped really low. And so they decided he needed further care as well and was sent in a neonatal ambulance to Mackay.
Mm-hmm.
Funny story, my husband was trying to come with us. Obviously, his wife had just gone. I imagine it would have been fairly traumatic for him as well. And then his son had been gone and he's ready to come to Mackay, but the keys to his car are in the bag with me that's gone in the first ambulance to Mackay. So he's had to wait until that first ambulance came back with his keys.
Okay.
luckily my father was in Mackay that day servicing his car, so he was there when I came out of surgery, and also my brother-in-law lives there as well, and I'm forever grateful to both of them, my dad and my brother-in-law, who came. You know, I had someone there.
Yeah, they when dropped I came and came. Yeah.
Yeah. And just to see a familiar face. And meanwhile, my 10-pound four baby was next to these tiny little preemies in the NICU with the, in the neonatal care. You could spot him a mile away because he was a big fat one over there. He ended up being fine, and I was fine, and we were reunited. And he, I was so worried that he wouldn't be able to feed, but you know, being separated for so long.
Mm-hmm.
But he went straight on to the breast and fed fine.
So how long was it before you two were back together?
I'm gonna say it might have been 4 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe a bit longer. I don't really know. Felt like a really long time.
Yeah.
So that was all good.
Had you had to go under general anaesthetic, or were you able to be awake while they did the surgery? You're under general?
No, so I was under general anaesthetic, so I had to wait. I was worried about that through my breast milk and all sorts of crazy things, but it all turned out okay, which was kind of good. I was glad I was under general because it took a bit of time for me not being aware and
feeling that being apart from your son. Yeah. How long were you in hospital then after you'd had your surgery?
Yeah, I stayed that night, and I was really missing my daughter.
Yeah.
So, and really wanted her to meet her brother. So we transferred and went back to the other hospital, and stayed there for another couple of nights.
Mm-hmm.
Just to help with the feeding, and obviously him being a massive baby had really high requirements of feed. So he was, it felt like as soon as he finished a feed, he needed another. And that was really tough, and he didn't sleep well, and certainly a difficult sort of a baby.
Two very different experiences, different kids.
So we spent a few nights there, And then maybe another couple of nights with my parents.
Yeah.
Obviously, I had pretty severe injuries to and then we drove home again.
And how was it driving after having had a tear? Because it can be quite hard to sit down at times after having that. Were you okay to sit, or did you use props?
I used props and sat in an awkward sort of position. Luckily, we only had the 1,000 Ks to go. I think we may have done that in 2 days just to give me a break.
Tears require a bit of tender love and care at times, like particularly as we go up the different degrees. Did anyone offer you some good postpartum healing advice? Strategies for helping with your tear?
The best things we had, they filled these condoms with water and froze them.
Yeah.
And they were just the best ice packs. Swelling. You need rest. You need to be off your feet. I really did need to try and do that, which is hard when you've got a toddler as well. And obviously Judy's on a farm. Painkillers, ice packs, and rest.
You just mentioned as well that you had duties on a farm. So after you've given birth, you're back onto the farm helping out as well.
Yeah.
Wow. Well,
yeah. When we were mustering, you know, it was quite an ordeal. So you might have, 6-8 staff there at different times that obviously you've got to do meals for them. I was lucky. I mean, I had a bit of a break, but then it might be, you know, something needs to be done, hay needs to be put in the yards for us or whatever it is, so you just get on with it and do it. I must say, after that birth though, it really was a traumatic experience. And it affected my relationship with my baby at the time. Mm-hmm. The midwife said to me when he came out, "Why is he so big? If your last baby was 7 pounds, why is this baby so big? Did you not have your glucose test?" And I said, "I did, and I passed it with flying colours." And at my, see, in the public system, you have the last scan at like 20 weeks. Mm-hmm. And I never had another scan or anything before he was born. And at that scan, at 20 weeks, he was on the 50th percentile. So a very average-sized baby. And, you know, there was no clear reason why. My husband and I are far from big people. It was just unclear. And I always looked at him. He had lots of, because he was so squashed inside, his ears were folded over, his toes were folded over. He had swelling in his face. And I looked at him all the time, just trying to find out, is there something wrong with him? I was paranoid, and I did lots of research, and I sort of thought that he might have had a genetic condition sort of thing, and I went to geneticist appointments and just tried to find out if there was something, and I found something called Beckwith-Wiedemann syndrome. And it is some enlarged organs and high birth weight, low blood sugar levels, a few of these markers that he had. And I thought, maybe he's got this. And so I took him to the geneticist and he said, yeah, look, he'd be borderline if he does have it, but I will write you out a diagnosis, in case, something goes wrong, because with those children, they have a higher risk of childhood cancer. Just be vigilant and watch him. And, I do feel like I didn't enjoy his time while he was a baby. And like I said, he didn't sleep. He fed all the time. He wanted to be held the whole time. And remembering before this, I thought I was like a really great mom and I thought I could birth well. And I thought, I thought I had this down pat. And that was, a really challenging time when he was a baby. Anyway, we soldiered on and he developed well, and he's a legend of a child. He's so cool. And nothing sort of further happened there. I do still stress every time he has a flu or a cold or something. He's the one that I'm like, right, are you okay?
Yeah.
But I think that's just the way it is. And before he was sort of, I think he was 10 months old and I found out I was pregnant again.
Quick, yeah. So feeling that kind of state of hypervigilance and then going into pregnancy, that would be hard.
Yeah. So we sort of thought after him, we may not have any more, because that was a bit traumatic and, struggling a little bit with him. So, although in the back of our minds, we always would have loved lots of children, we thought this might be enough for us. Mm. And before we could make that decision formally, I found out I was pregnant again.
Yeah. And so after two very different birthing experiences and the second having that kind of lingering feeling of being quite vigilant, you chose to move to elective C-section for birth number 3 in Mackay. How did you come to that decision? Mm-hmm. Or was that something that you kind of pretty immediately knew, if you were ever going to have a baby again, that you were going to go there?
So hadn't really talked about another child yet. Only that we might not have any more. And when the day I went to the doctor, because I was sick again on the couch, and my husband said, something's wrong with you. You're depressed. There's something wrong with you. You've got to get checked out. Because third time around again, I suffered from severe morning sickness. Well, I like to call it day sickness, because it lasted all day, all night, every day.
For the whole pregnancy?
The whole pregnancy of all three. And I went into the clinic in Croydon again. We had this really cool clinic nurse in there. And he said, yeah, you're pregnant. And so, right, well, that'll be a C-section from that day. that is what was going to happen. And I, was so sick again and had two toddlers now to look after. And I would go into Croydon and he would hook me up to a drip and just give me some fluids, because in each of my pregnancies as well, I would lose a severe amount of weight. He would give me the fluids and I would lay in there for a couple of hours and go home, and I'd feel quite refreshed and I'd have a good couple of days of feeling okay. And I was like, oh, I'm a winner here. it really, really did help out. But I was also conscious of not wanting to sort of do that too much as well, just not knowing, always wanted to be as natural as I could. Mm. Because I had tried through the other pregnancies, I'd tried all the pills that they you know, suggested that was safe, because I just, you know, was really struggling, and none of them worked. So I never took anything. But yeah, the drip did help, definitely. Mm. So yeah, for the third, I found an obstetrician, went private, and went to Mackay this time. So yeah, three babies born in three different places in Queensland. And yeah, had an obstetrician there, and I loved the fact that you knew the exact day it was coming out. Mm-hmm. You know, you could arrange everything. You know, my husband didn't need to leave the farm until, you know, right before he was definitely going to be there. All of those other things you stress about when you're far away. Yeah, booked in, sliced, diced, sewed me back up, and loved the experience. Absolutely loved it. They pulled the you know, the screen down and said, "Have a look, Taryn. You can watch coming out." Pulled him out, brought him straight up to me. Obviously, it's not too much connection straight away after C-section. My husband held him and put him near my face, and it really wasn't long before, you know, they clean you all up and then send you into recovery. And I arrived in recovery, and my husband was holding him and put him straight onto me, and he took straight to the breast. And yeah, I could recommend that to anyone.
Yeah, it sounds like intuitively you knew what you needed, and that's actually quite a healing birthing experience after your second birth experience being quite traumatic.
Yeah. And I think because I felt in charge, I'd made the decisions and the plans, and whereas the previous one, I was very much, you know, out of control. You know, nothing I could do to get that baby out. I had to just rely on everyone else around me to try and get him out. So, for the C-section, I really loved it. Recovery. I preferred to nurse an injury on my stomach than between my legs. It was much easier to nurse that, and obviously trying not to pick up my, you know, my middle child was a baby himself still at the time, and a toddler, so, you know, trying not to lift them, but, you know, we're pretty tough, aren't we, and we do what we need to do as much.
That does make sense as well, because cesarean sections, they're cutting quite straight lines, whereas tears, particularly not episiotomy but tears, they occurring naturally just kind of go, and it can be more multi-directional when you've got tears, whereas it's a, I guess, nonsensical and then a very sensical kind of way to come back together.
And I think, I mean, with the tears, you know, you need to go to the toilet so many times in a day.
Yeah.
And you're thinking of that wound every moment. So, it was really unpleasant. Like I said, loved that cesarean.
So postpartum recovery, there wasn't really too much to it. Did anyone need to check up on your cesarean scar at all? Were they able to do that in Croydon?
Yeah, like I've always, you know, they say come back for the checkup and that, but I think you know yourself, don't you, whether you feel well and whether it looks right or something was not up. But yeah, I healed fine, and they checked it in Croydon, and it all looked well, and it healed fine. So
yeah,
I was very lucky.
And for like postpartum or motherhood kind of experiences or breastfeeding or anything, have you ever used any of the hotlines, like different phone lines that you're able to call on, or just kind of felt that you've got that sphere of support in family and your mate with kids up the road?
Mostly used my neighbour. She got called a fair bit. And my mum, and then in real emergencies, the RFDS is probably the number that I would call the most. Mm-hmm. Mainly because they connect with your local clinic as well. And can sort of, you knows a bit more about your location, whereas I have found some of the hotlines, you could be ringing someone in Sydney and they have no idea you're like, 65.
Go see a lactation consultant and it's like, there are no lactation consultants.
So I think, I think in general, if medical professionals in general, not just for pregnancy, knew more of the challenges of remote living, it would be beneficial for everyone. I know just, you would try and book an appointment to get the babies in to a paediatrician, say, and they're obviously, some of those professionals are booked up for months, and you think, well, I've only got one opportunity to go away to town because we start mustering, the week after, and I've got this one opportunity to get to the city. Can you not fit me in? And some of them, they just have, no, we don't have an appointment until, how about you come in on the 27th? And you think, I can't do that. I just can't come any day that you pull out. I can only come between these times. And I think, in general, if more people understood that, it would be a lot more helpful.
Yeah. So, like, to increase, because in a way it's like there really isn't more that we can do for every single property around Australia, but to increase the quality of whether it's prenatal or birthing or postpartum care for rural and remote women, it would just be to increase the level of consideration, to have a more considerate care model.
Absolutely. Consideration and awareness, really. Because, you do talk to some people and try and explain where you live or how you got there or what have you, and they're just like, wow, just have no idea.
Yeah.
No idea what I went through, putting three kids in the car and driving for 600 kilometres to make an appointment that you've cancelled, or, whatever it is, the issue is. You think, oh my goodness,
And that's even the same from rural context to rural context, because like I'm rural, but I'm 2.5 hours from Sydney. That is about 350 kilometres away, I think. Worlds apart to experiences of 2,500 kilometres from Brisbane.
It's character building. That's what I always said. It's not, it wasn't an easy start for us, but we certainly and absolutely appreciate, everything that, you gain from those experiences. So. Yeah.
And I can hear that in your story, that like you've got this amazing sense of ability to take stuff on. Like, if it's a hard yakka, you're just like, yeah, it's okay. I've got that. Like, I accept that that's something that we've got to deal with. So for women who are living remotely, what advice would you offer them, or a message or something that you think they need to know about to move through these difficult experiences? Because you've obviously got an amazing ability to do that.
I mean, I think I've met a lot of rural women, and I know, you know, they're all tough, and that experience you gain just from being remote and rural in itself is so beneficial to, you know, every path you cross in the future, and certainly for pregnancy and birth, and when you have to relocate, of course, that toughness, it really comes in handy. The resilience that you have just from living where you live is really helpful. And then the other piece of advice I would have is just find a mate, find a friend that you can tell anything to. You only have to have one person. You know, you don't need to surround yourself with a mother's group if that's not available to you. I mean, there is every now and then where I feel a pinge of jealousy that I never did have a mother's group. But it's not available to everyone, and you only need one person. So
from the sounds of it as well, that person doesn't even have to live close.
No, that's right. Just, someone you can pick up the phone any time of day.
Thank you again to Taryn for sharing what it's like as a pregnant, remote woman and travelling thousands of kilometres in order to birth. If you would also like to share your rural birth story, please get in touch on Instagram at rural_births or send me an email, ruralbirths@gmail.com. And again, thank you for listening.